Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Julie and I am an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our own personal stories describes in our own language and from our own point of view the way we established our relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in our lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker and believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, "Yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing." I have the pleasure of introducing our speaker tonight. I do not know Harold, but I do know that he's an alcoholic, so I suspect I know him better than I think I do. But with that, I give you Harold.
My name's Harold Lipkin, and I am an alcoholic. And let me get a few things out of the way up front. First of all, happy birthday, Tim. 14 years, that's great. After I congratulate you, let me tell you that I got a resentment towards you, too. Most of the people here must not know that there's a football game going on right now. And when I accepted Tim's offer to speak here, I didn't have my whole calendar in front of me and didn't realize what was going on tonight. As I was getting ready, though, because I was thinking of all kinds of ways that maybe we could work around this, but I am committed to Alcoholics Anonymous, so I didn't want to back out, but my toilet was overflowing. And I thought, well, this would be an ideal excuse, and I'd like to tell you that the reason why I didn't back out of it was because of my commitment to AA. But the truth of the matter is, I knew that Tim wouldn't believe me if I told him that. So it was more about what somebody might think of me than an actual commitment. Now, I'd like to tell you a couple of things about a couple of dates. And by the way, this guy here, I don't know if anybody else in this room knew Stan, but Stan was quite a devoted member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hadn't noticed that this podium had been dedicated to Stan, but Stan was a great member of AA and a great servant. So if any of you know any stories about Stan, please share them with each other, because he's a good example of what this program embodies. I was born April 20th, 1949. For those of you who are mathematically challenged, that makes me 67 years old. Oh, I like him. He's going. I got sober on August 23rd, 1982. So that means I've been sober for a little bit better than 34 years. And I got married on November 10th, 1985. And the reason why I give you those last two dates is because those are the only two commitments that I think I've ever really kept in my entire life. But they're probably the two things that I've worked the hardest at and the two things that have given me the most back to. So just keep that in mind as we move forward in my little journey tonight. I noticed that in the opening you guys say that you hope you won't take anything in bad taste. And I can tell you that before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was the embodiment of bad taste. And sometimes since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, I can also be the embodiment of bad taste. But if I keep working the steps and I keep not drinking, then I think that my behavior continues to improve. And by the way, I have some evidence of that. I haven't knowingly stole anything in 34 years or deliberately stole anything in 34 years. And I haven't slept with any of my friends' wives in 34 years. So those are two behavioral changes. I'd like to tell you that I haven't lied in 34 years, but that would be a lie. And if you listen real carefully, there's a couple of guys in this room tonight who know me. If you listen real carefully tonight, you'll probably be able to pick up on a lie or two that I might tell tonight, too. But I'm working at it. I'm trying to get better. As you may have been able to decipher from my accent, I'm not a native of Atlanta, although I did spend 8 years here as a kid and had the good sense to eventually, even though I was drunk when I got back here, I eventually made it back here. But I was born in Middletown, Connecticut. We moved to Atlanta when I was 3 years old. We moved back up to New Jersey when I was 10, and that's where I spent my formative years. That's where I grew up. And then I made several geographic cures before I got back to Atlanta when I was 25. And then I got sober when I was 33. And I got sober here in Atlanta out at the Lawrenceville group, which was at the Lawrenceville Presbyterian Church out in Lawrenceville, Georgia, out in old Lawrenceville Highway, old 29. And that meeting still exists out there as far as I know. It's been quite a journey since then. I'd like to tell you that when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous that I took to it, you know, like a duck takes to water and just lived happily ever after. But that's not what you're going to hear from me tonight. I was one of those guys who, because I was young and because I hadn't physically gone that far down, I cleaned up pretty good. And when I cleaned up pretty good, there's a problem there, because what happened to me was I began to know more than you. And instead of listening, I started to do a lot of talking. And I can tell you that several people suggested, and I don't hear this phrase very often, but I think it's germane. Several people suggested that I take the cotton out of my ears and put it in my mouth. And I didn't take that advice for a long time. And so I'm one of those guys who didn't hit a real bottom outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hit a bottom after I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you're going to hear, you hear a lot of stories in AA about how people came in and they were living in a cardboard box, and, you know, now they have $1 billion, or they you know, run a multinational company. Well, I came into AA with a good job, making a lot of money, and pretty well respected in my field. And after I was here for 2 or 3 years, I was out of work and close to bankrupt. And that was because when I got into AA, I hadn't lost everything, and God and y'all kept trying to shake me and trying to get me to listen. And finally, I think that God in its infinite, in His infinite wisdom, just shook me hard enough to help me lose some things so that He might get my attention and I might start listening. Because I was one of those guys who, once I cleaned up, man, I knew it all. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, like I said, with a pretty decent job and a pretty decent reputation for being able to get things done, and didn't realize how far down I had gone. We talk about Skid Row as if it's a physical place. And for me, I wasn't on a physical Skid Row, but I will match my mental and emotional Skid Row with anybody's. So when I got here and I cleaned up, I looked good and I sounded good, but inside I was pretty well torn up. And it took me a while to, and when I say a while, I'll give you some dates here. I was sober 9-10 years, and I got a huge promotion at work. And I was put in charge of a couple of divisions. And the guy who was turning it over to me showed me some books and said, "This is completely off the record." Said, "Now this fund, which was a rather large fund, Nobody knows about it, and you can do anything you want with this money. And that's the way it's been operated. You know, Tom, that's the way Tom operated it before. That's the way I operated it, and now I'm passing it on to you. And I'll take it down. I'll take you down to the bank and get your signature cards. And I made a big mistake. I called my sponsor to tell him about this windfall. And I explained to him, you know, the whole thing. And then I said, and the beauty of it is that nobody knows who it belongs to. And he said to me, no, the beauty of it is we know who it doesn't belong to. But that was 9-10 years sober that I had to be told. That's why when I said to you in the beginning that I haven't knowingly or deliberately stolen since I got sober, I didn't know what honesty really was. You know, you'll hear a lot about that we need spiritual honesty and that it's not about cash register honesty. Well, I got to tell you, it is about cash register honesty. Because until I understand cash register honesty, until I understand that I can't reach into Ian's pocket and take money out of his pocket, I will never understand any wider or greater concept of honesty. So if somebody's telling you don't worry about cash register honesty, just worry about this spiritual concept of honesty, I'd start getting my spiritual advice from somebody else. Because I'm just kidding myself when I believe that kind of thing. And so that was 9-10 years sober. I'm 19 years sober, and I'm still reading in the book down on the page where it says the farmer comes out of the wind cellar or storm cellar and says to his wife, ain't it grand that the wind stopped blowing? I didn't understand. I'm 18, 19 years sober at the time and didn't understand what the issue was with that. You know, that was perfectly relevant, perfectly, you know, good statement to me. I was 20 years sober and still didn't get what the advantage of ceasing fighting everybody and everything was. So I was a slow learner, and I still am a slow learner. I continued to come back. I continued to work the steps. I got what saved my rear end was I was very involved in service. And I was, when I say service, I mean the formal service structure of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a state officer when I was 9 years sober, and on the office committee, and I've continued to do things in service. So it kept me in the middle of the program. I started sponsoring guys very early on. Somebody sent me a guy when I was 4 or 5 months sober. Sent me a guy to sponsor, and I told him I didn't think I should be sponsoring anybody with only 4 or 5 when I only had 4 or 5 months. And I called Dwight, who was the guy who had sent this kid to me, and Dwight told me, hell, you know how to stay sober for 4 or 5 months, right? And I said, yeah. He said, well, tell the kid how to do that. You know, so I was pushed into that right away. I was pushed into doing 12-step calls. I got to tell you something about 12-step calls, too. Be careful. I'm one of those guys who really, since I came in crawling in and begging for help, and nobody pushed me in here, and I wasn't intervened on, so, you know, I share my experience, strength, and hope. That's the way I have to go with this, too. So I learned very quickly that to make sure that I talk to whoever it is I'm going out to see, and I don't take somebody else's word for it. And I'll give you an example. My sponsor at the time, I was a couple of years sober, was a guy named Glenn Strickland. And his wife, Natalie, was also in the program. And Glenn and I had been out to dinner and to a meeting or something, and we came home. And Natalie said, well, we got a call for somebody who needs to see you guys. Maybe you could go over there. And she didn't explain the whole thing. Glenn just got the address or whatever. We go over to, there was a out here off of Shallowford Road someplace. We go over there, And the wife answers the door and says, well, I'll go back and get him. And we go back to the room, and the window is open, and the curtains are blown. He had gone out the back window. Well, it turns out that he had never asked for help. She had called the central office. The central office had put her in touch with Natalie. Natalie had assumed that, you know, that he had made the call. And so we're going over there, and this guy never wanted any help. So I've always made it a policy to make sure that wherever I'm going, I've been asked to go. And I always take somebody with me, too. No matter how well you know the person, or how well you think you know the situation, it's a good idea to take somebody with you. We had a fellow by the name of Doc Crandall, who was notorious for making 12-step calls, notorious for working with people. And Doc had a guy who he had sponsored over the years. And the guy, he knew the guy very well. And the guy went back out, and Doc went over to his house by himself. And Doc died that night because he was trying to take a gun away from him. So that's one of the reasons why we just, no matter how well we think we know a situation, we don't go by ourselves. So that's, and we don't see, you know, we don't see as much of that 12-stepping as we used to. When I first came in the program, treatment centers were kind of taken off, but we still had a lot of people who were coming in off the street. And that's the way I came in. I didn't go to a treatment center. I called up a guy who I had done business with. He had told me, one night when we were at a play, Theater of the Stars, at halftime, or I guess they call it intermission, right? At intermission of this play, I offered him a drink. And he said, no, I don't drink. And I said, really? He said, yeah, I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, he just kind of passingly told me that. And I kind of filed it away. And then my last weekend, which I call my lost weekend, when I realized that alcohol was not working for me anymore. And by the way, I didn't come to I'm not going to give you a drunk log. I tell you this. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous because I got in a bunch of trouble, although I did. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous because the law was chasing me in, although it could have been. The reason why I came to Alcoholics Anonymous is that I woke up and found that alcohol was no longer working for me. See, as long as alcohol still worked for me, I'd still be out there today. Well, I'd probably be dead or institutionalized, but I never would have stopped drinking if alcohol still worked. Because alcohol spelled relief for me. When I picked up a drink of alcohol, I knew that I didn't know where I was going to end up. And I did not care. Because I knew the one place I wasn't going to end up was looking at me. I was going to be able to get away from me. And as long as I could get away from me, I didn't care what the consequences are. 2 years before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew that I couldn't control my drinking, and I have a date in which I actually said it. I was, like I told you, I had a pretty good job. I'm going to tell you several times how successful I was and how successful I am, because I'm still kind of a legend in my own mind. So you're just going to have to put up with that. But it was at least 2 years before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was working for a company, and I was one of the guys. There were five of us who were running the company, and there was an owner. And he would get us together for a monthly management meeting where we would discuss the strategy of the business. And we were in the hospitality business, so we would normally go out to one of the nicer restaurants that was one of our customers, and we'd have a meeting there. And we'd usually, you know, tie it on pretty good. And this one night, we were going to make some decisions that were going to influence our path for several years to come. And so Joe asked us not to get too schnockered, not to get too drunk before we got the business out of hand, out of the way. And we went over to Panos and Paul's, and we sat there, and Joe finally looked over at me because I wasn't drinking, and Joe said, "Harold, I didn't say don't drink. I said, you know, let's not get, you know, too out of hand." And I looked at Joe and remember clearly saying to him, "I can't do that." I knew long before I got here that I could not control my drinking. I knew long before I got here that when I picked up a drink, I had no idea where it was going to take me, but I didn't care. I absolutely didn't care because it took me to a place of relief. And when the day came that I no longer got that relief, I went into complete panic. And I remember the last night that I drank, I used to keep a bottle of it, a bottle or two bottles of Stolichnaya vodka in the freezer at my house. And I remember grabbing that bottle one night. I got up, I couldn't sleep. It was 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, and I grabbed that bottle and I poured myself a tumbler full of vodka. And I drank it down, and I poured another tumbler and drank it down, and then looked over at on the counter. There was a butcher knife there, and I looked at that knife and I said, "Well, thank God I'm not suicidal." And in a moment of clarity, a thought came to me that, "Who are you kidding? You're killing yourself with this alcohol." And I'd like to tell you that that I put away the bottle and called AA and lived happily ever after. But the truth of the matter is, I poured another tumbler and drank some more, and couldn't get that relief. So the next day I went to the office early, which was kind of a surprise because most people weren't used to seeing me in the office early. I went in the office early and I shut my door and I started calling everything in the phone book that had alcohol, alcoholism, or alcoholics in front of it. And these people kept saying things to me, like I would call a treatment center and they would say, "Well, you can come in for an evaluation." And I was like, "Hell, evaluation? I don't need to be evaluated. I just, you know, need y'all to take care of me." And finally it dawned on me that Clint, this guy Clint Daniel, that I was still doing business with, he had said to me at the intermission of this show that he didn't drink and he went to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I called Clint and I said to him, "Didn't you tell me once that you quit drinking?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, how'd you do that?" And he said, "Well, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous." I said, "I know you went to Alcoholics Anonymous, but how'd you quit drinking?" And he said, "I go to Alcoholics Anonymous." And I said, "I know you go to Alcoholics Anonymous. We've been through this. How'd you quit drinking?" And he said, "Harold, do you have somebody who needs help?" You know, because we alcoholics, we're clueless, right? I mean, and I said, "Yeah, me." And the story that I get later on was he was married to Amy, and Amy's a black belt Al-Anon. And he went home and said, "Amy, you are never," and Amy was involved in the business too, so she'd be in the office 2 or 3 times a week. So she knew me pretty well because we had done business for several years. And he went home and said, "Amy, you're never going to guess who called me and wants help." And she said, "Harold Itkin." Clint, the alcoholic, didn't have a clue. Amy, you know, knew the minute she saw me, the first day she was ever with me, she had made a comment to her friend Marge Montgomery, who was also a black belt Al-Anon. She had made the comment to Marge, "You need to meet this guy, Harold, because he's eventually going to end up with us." And sure enough, I did. And the way that we did it back then was so... When I called Clint, he realized who it was that needed help, that it was me. He asked me to do something for him. He said, Can you not take a drink between now and 7 o'clock tonight? And I said, well, you know, I can try it. Well, actually, I didn't say I can try. I was, you know, I still wasn't, you know, I wasn't falling apart yet. So I wasn't whimpering yet. So I said, oh, yeah, I can do that, you know. And by about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, that was becoming a lot more difficult. I was like, and by the time I met up with Clint at 7 o'clock that night, he took one look at me and realized that we weren't going to make it through the evening. So he told me to follow him to his house before we went to the meeting. So I followed him to his house, and we pulled into his nice, beautiful house with the pool in the back and all the things that I wanted. And, you know, they say, if you want what we have, you'll do what we do. Well, he had what I wanted. We pulled into his house, and he stopped, and I didn't. So my first act in Alcoholics Anonymous was to run into my future sponsor's car. And he took me to a meeting that night. And I got to tell you that the time between like 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon when I had finally gotten in touch with Clint and 7 o'clock that night before I got to him was probably the loneliest and toughest time of my entire life, because those were the 5 or 6 hours that I spent without alcohol and without Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's a bad deal. That's a bad deal. Because I don't resent my drinking, and I don't have ill thoughts about alcohol. Alcohol kept me alive long enough to get to you guys. But I always had to have something, and those were the 5 or 6 hours that I had nothing. And that was the worst time in my life. And then I came to a meeting that night, and I don't remember what went on in that meeting. I don't remember much of what was said, but I remember this. I remember that I walked in that meeting with no hope, and I remember I left that meeting with hope. And the reason why I left that meeting with hope was because somehow or some way I felt that you people had been where I was, and you weren't there anymore. And I still was. You know, they almost called our book The Way Out, but they found out that somebody had already had a book, The Way Out. So eventually, we ended up with Alcoholics Anonymous, because naturally, nobody had taken that name before. But and that's what I found that night was, I didn't find the way out, but I found the people that had the way out. I didn't find the keys to the kingdom, as they say, but I found the people who I thought might have those keys. And, you know, I told you that I was a slow learner, and I told you that I struggled for a long time in this program, but the one thing that I never stopped believing was that you guys had the way out and that you guys had the keys to the kingdom. Never, ever stop believing that. So as tough as things got in AA, and I'm telling you, you know that great job that I had? Year sober, gone. I had deaths happen. I had breakups. I had all kinds of things. And I somehow didn't pick up a drink because I knew that I'd lose sight of the people that had the way out, the people that had the keys to the kingdom, if I did that. And so just based on that hope, that identification that I felt that first night, I continued to come back. And eventually something clicked. But I tell you, it took a long time for things to click for me. A long time. You know, I'm married to a wonderful woman. Jenny is she's great. I don't know why she stuck by me. Actually, that's not true. I'm a great guy. That's why she stuck by me. And we've been through a lot. We've been through a lot together. It's taken work. And that's, but I met Jenny after I was sober for a couple of years, and we've had a great life so far. It ain't over so far. But it's also, there's been trials and tribulations, and we just keep coming back. She's also in the program. But we've gone through a lot together. After 20 years, she went out. And people, we had always agreed that if we ever went out, because we both had a couple of years, we both had a little bit better than 3 years when we got married. And that was my first marriage. And I take marriage very seriously. And but we said that the one thing that would break this thing up is if either one of us goes out. And she went out, and she kept asking me. When she came back, she kept asking me, "Are you gonna leave?" And I didn't know what the answer to that was. And it's interesting. And I don't mean to say anything against our sister or brother program, Al-Anon, but people were telling me to go to Al-Anon, and so I went. I went to Al-Anon for a while, but I had to be very careful, because what I didn't realize was how much in jeopardy my program was also, and how close I was to taking a drink. So what I eventually did, I sat down with my sponsor, and we realized that I didn't need to worry about my relationship with her at that point. I needed to worry about my sobriety. So I needed to get my ass back into AA. And that's what I did. And I found the answers here, too. And I found the answers not just to my sobriety, but I found the answers to my relationship, too. And basically what it amounts to, and it's the message to me, it's the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the message of Alcoholics Anonymous is that we want to look for what we can give, not what we can get. See, I was the guy who woke up in the morning with myself and what I was going to get on my mind. I was the guy who woke up in the morning and that list that you make in the morning, or that I make in the morning, always consisted of the things that I was going to do, but that list always had a payback. Do this, get this. Do this, get this. Do this, get this. And I was listening to a tape of a guy named Chuck Chamberlain, who probably next to Bill Wilson was probably at one time, not probably, next to Bill Wilson, at one time Chuck Chamberlain was the most well-known person in Alcoholics Anonymous, both inside and outside the program. Now, those of you who have heard of Chuck may not even know, Chuck was actually a minister, too. He was a lay minister, which is one of the reasons why he was so well-spoken. But this guy could communicate. This guy was the great communicator. And one of the things, I used to be an avid tape listener. You know, back when I got sober, they had tapes. They didn't have CDs. I hate to tell you, when I got sober, they didn't even have laptops. I don't think we had mobile phones when I got sober. I don't want you to think I'm old or anything. I got sober when I was 10. Oh, I already told you that, so much. Anyways, Chuck, I was listening to Chuck, and I realized what he was saying. And what he was saying was, he went back to his place of work, and his boss tried to throw him, you know, had fired him. And Chuck came back and said, "I owe you. I'm going to clean the slate. I'm going to get my side of the street clean. And if you try and stop me, I'm going to throw you out the window." And he did it for nothing. He just went back and he cleaned up his side of the street. And then he started every day thinking about what he was going to add to rather than what he was going to take away from. And I will tell you that when I got completely miserable, I started to think, well, maybe the old fart's got a point. And so I started making a list in the morning of maybe two or three things that I was going to do that were going to benefit somebody else or benefit a situation, and I was going to get nothing out of. And I started to feel better. And I would get into a plateau where that feeling would last. And then I'd feel so good that I'd start to reward myself. And so I'd start to think about the things that I could get because I was so good. And then I'd forget all about what Chuck said. And I'd get back into that old thing. And then I'd get the heebie-jeebies and wonder why I didn't feel good. And then I'd realize, oh, you're back to thinking about what you're going to take away rather than what you're going to bring. And you'd think that after all this time that I would have learned. But that's still the case. Invariably, when I am not feeling right, I will tell you that it's because I'm thinking about what I'm going to get rather than what I'm going to give. It's just that simple for me. When I am thinking about you and what I'm going to do for you, I'm doing good. When I'm thinking about me and what I'm going to do for me, invariably I start to go down a dark hole. And that's what this thing is about. It's about service. It's about love, and it's about service. Now, I had to do a lot of cleaning up. And fortunately, because if you follow the tenets of this program, it'll happen. Even though you don't think it'll happen, it'll happen. I cleaned up things with my mother. There had always been tension between my mother and I because I always felt like she treated my brother better than she treated me. And when she was diagnosed with a terminal illness, I got to spend a lot of time with her. And one day I finally had the nerve to really bring it up, you know, that. And I brought it up in a gentle fashion. I said that my brother's name was Malcolm, and I said, you know, I always had the feeling that you treated me different than Malcolm. And I'm going to tell you, my mother, as much she was dying from multiple myeloma, and I don't know if you know what that is, but it's a cancer that attacks the bones, and it's very, very painful. Attacks your skeletons. And so she was in a lot of pain. And she didn't like to laugh, but she laughed like hell. And when she got finished laughing, she finally looked up at me and she said, "Of course I treated you differently. You were two different people." And you know what? Next thing you're going to tell me is now that we've got this out in the open that I was harder on you. And she said, and that's right. I was harder on you because you were more capable than him. And we cleaned all that up. I had some terrible issues with my father. And we cleaned that up. I had some bad issues with my brother, and we never cleaned that up. And I would say, I would look up at God and say, when is it going to happen for me? You know, because I'd hear all these wonderful stories in AA about how, you know, the family was gone and it came back and whatever. And I would look up at God and I would say, when is it going to happen for me? You know. I had made, after I was sober for I guess it was about 3 years, I was going up to, my brother was still living up in Massachusetts, and I was going up for a family event, and I was going to be staying with him, and the meeting that night, I was going to Skyland, the meeting that night, a guy named Clarence Roberts, who was one of the icons of Atlanta AA, and I knew Clarence really well. Clarence chose as the topic that night, is there an amend that you haven't made? And of course, I had never made this amend to my brother. And so I had to declare, he called on me, and so I had to declare right there in front of 60 people at Skyland that there was this amend, and that and Clarence, you know, that was back when that. They didn't care about crosstalk. So Clarence said, "Well, will you have an opportunity? When are you going to see him?" And I said, "Well, the day after tomorrow." So I had kind of made a declaration or a commitment that I was going to take care of that, clean that up. So I had to clean that up that weekend. And I was staying at his place, and the family thing we were going to was like 30 or 40 minutes away, so we had a drive, And on the way back, I chose to start to do that, and I went on for about 35 or 40 minutes. So I guess it was more like a 45-minute to an hour drive. And when I got finished, I figured, man, here we go. And my brother pulled the car over, and he said, "I'm pulling the car over because I want to look you straight in the face when I tell you this. First of all, I hope you don't think that this cleans everything up between us, number one. Number two, this is what you left out." And he proceeded to give me about 30 or 40 minutes worth of stuff that he felt that I had done that I had not come clean about. And then he finished off by saying, "I hope you don't think that this little conversation is going to mean that we walk off hand in hand and live happily ever after as loving brothers." So again, I look up at God and I say, "When? You know, when is it going to happen for me?" And we went on and had several years of a very, very contentious relationship. And then it came to a point, I won't get into detail, I don't have time, but we ceased to talk. And it also, my father got in the middle of it, and it caused problems with me and my father. And I felt, you know, like it was going down the tubes. And I just didn't know, but I just kept putting one foot in front of the other. My brother died, And my father got a chance. He got sick right after that, and he had a chance to spend some time with my wife, because my wife was going up there to take care of my father. And because of that, he and I were able to get right. And then after my brother had died, his wife came to me and said, "I don't know what went on between you and your brother. And I don't really care what went on between you and your brother. Your influence on my boys would be a good influence. So if we can, I'd like for you and me to start over again so that the boys can have the benefit of a relationship with you. Stick around. The miracle will happen. Stick around. The miracle will happen. You don't know what form. I don't know what form." That's not what I thought was going to happen. True joy. And this is a strange way for true joy to happen, but when my brother died, he also had not been very responsible in terms of finances. And his oldest son was in getting ready, was in the beginning of his junior year in college, and there was nothing there. So this kid was going to have to drop out of college. And I was able to help him get through the rest of college. And I just felt that it was the right thing to do. I wasn't looking for any pat on the back or anything. And I got to tell you, sometimes I did it begrudgingly. Never told him that, but, you know, sometimes I just look up and say, "You got a great sense of humor, God, thanks, you know." But at his graduation, he was on the cover of the graduation program, because he had done some pretty impressive things. And the sense of pride that I had was unbelievable. But the best thing was, we were at a party in the hotel, and we were riding up in the elevator. My wife and I were riding up in the elevator, and this other couple was on there, and we introduced, because most of the people in the hotel were part of the graduation, and this other couple introduced themselves to us, and it turned out that it was his girlfriend's mother. And she realized who I was, and she said to me, "Oh, you're the one." Now, you know, 30 years ago, somebody said to me, "You're the one," I ducked or ran. But she said, "You're the one." And I said, and I kind of looked at her, and she said, "Ari," that's my nephew's name, "Ari said that he never would have gotten through if it hadn't have been for you." Now, that was the sense of true joy. I had actually made an impact on another human being's life, a sizable impact, helped them do something they couldn't do on their own, got nothing in return, supposedly, right? But the sense of joy that I got from that was the return. You know, there's a concept in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm gonna close this off in a minute or two. There's a concept in Alcoholics Anonymous called spiritual anonymity, and I was told early on that it's the act of doing good things and expecting nothing in return, and also not telling anybody about it. And I heard that concept when I was in my first year of sobriety. So for 34 years, I've been trying to do a good thing, expect nothing in return, and I've managed, I think, to accomplish that. But I've also been trying not to tell anybody about it. And so far, I haven't done that. And I got a feeling that the way that it's going to happen is I'm going to do this good act, and then I'm going to have a heart attack and drop dead, and I'm not going to have a chance to tell anybody about it, and I finally get to accomplish that. The message that I want to leave you with is two things. What's gotten me to where I am, and I'm a reasonably happy, joyous, and free person. I enjoy what I do. You know, I had a conversation today with Tom H., who's a former delegate of ours, former chairperson. He's now a candidate for trustee. And I had a conversation with Tom about retirement today. And Tom was talking about the financial end of it. And I said, you know what, Tom? A lot of people think that I've done well financially, but that's a ruse, you know. Good impression. But so they talked to me about finances. But I said to him that the question you need to ask first is, do you like what you're doing? Because then retirement doesn't come into play. And I like what I'm doing now, so I supposedly retired several years ago, like 3 or 4 years ago. But I've been doing consulting in that area because I like what I do. So it's about doing what you like. It's about enjoying myself, and then I can worry about the results later on. And a lot of what I do is bringing things to people. A lot of what I do is helping organizations and helping people. And I go into a lot of stuff without knowing what the return is going to be. And invariably, when I go in not knowing what the return is, no matter what it is, I end up, if I can bring to the situation, I end up being better off. That's my message. I don't know if anybody got anything out of this tonight or not. I certainly did, because I love the sound of my own voice. And I, again, congratulate you on 14 years, Tim, and I thank you for asking me, even if it didn't interfere with the national championship game. You know, when they started playing years ago, they started playing the NCAA basketball finals. They moved it. I'm so old, I remember when the format was a little bit different. But they moved it to where they had the national semifinals on Saturday, and they had the finals on Monday night. And that's the way it was when I came into AA. And so a couple of years sober, one of my sponsees told me that he'd see me at the meeting tonight, and it happened to be the night of the national finals. And I told him you know what NCAA stands for? And he said, yeah, National Collegiate Athletic Association. I said, no, it stands for No Coming to AA. So I broke that tonight for you, buddy. Thank you, and I love you.
That is wonderful. Thank you for bringing your story to us, Harold. We appreciate you taking time off of the busy football schedule to be with us. 4 years ago, they didn't have DVRs either, so now they do. So nobody talk. If you are looking on your phone, don't tell Harold what's happening. Okay. We've asked Tinsley to give out the chips.
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for coming here and sharing your experience, strength, and hope with us. It was really great. I remember that one. Here at this meeting, we have a chip system to mark our time away from our last drink. If you'd like to try this way of life one day at a time, we offer a white chip. Would anybody like to pick up a white chip? After 30 days, we have a silver chip, a red chip for 90 days. Anybody got 6 months, we have a yellow chip for that. We have a green chip for 9 months. Are there any birthdays we don't know about?
I'll make this quick. Hey, everybody. My name's Ian. I'm an alcoholic. I'm one of Harold's sponsees. This is 28 years for me. Maverick has a very special place in my heart. This is my very first meeting 28 years ago. And I still remember getting that white chip here. And so anyway, glad you're still here. And very inspirational talk tonight, Harold. Thank you.
And then we have a special presentation, I believe, for a home group member.
Well, it's a special celebrant. I don't know about the presentation. I'm Tim. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Tim.
And Tim is my sponsor. He actually celebrated 14 years last Friday. So he was sober 4 years and 3 months when I asked him to be my sponsor. And I thought he had the whole thing down. I really did. But he did tell me that first night that I met him, that he said a little something that kind of got me, that he needed me maybe more than I might need him. And it just got my thinking going. And now it's several years later, and I'm wishing you a happy birthday.
Thank you, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tim. I'm Tim. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Harold, so much. I really enjoyed your story. I love this meeting. It's been great working with this meeting for 12 years. This meeting got down. NAPA was going to do something else with it, and I just started announcing it. Every meeting I went to announce it started building up. Then a few years later, Tim came in, and he does all the heavy lifting now with the meeting. But I appreciate you being here. I love this meeting. I love the commitment. You know, I heard early on commitment's important, and I've always took that seriously. And you know, Alcoholics Anonymous has been so good to me. And one thing I'll say, you mentioned retirement, and I told somebody the other day, I was thinking about my birthday, and I said, you know, I don't know if I'll ever retire, but I feel like, as far as from a job, but I feel like I retired from the hardest job I could ever imagine 14 years ago. And that was living life the way I was living it. I mean, talk about a hard job. That was a hard job. And this really is such an easier, softer way and a pleasure and a gift. It's just a gift. And I want to take care of that gift. So thanks, everybody.
All right. Any other birthdays? And I would just like to jump in and say congratulations, Tim. Thank you so much for what you do for my home group, which is this meeting, and for what you do for the clubhouse and what you do for my program. And I really appreciate it. We offer the white chip one more time.
Why is that?
In case you don't know what one is, that means you need it. Big hand for the chips you hold.
Thank you. Congratulations, Tim. I don't know if you saw it, but a cake just went that way, so don't leave here without a piece of it. Thank you, one and all, for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight.
I'm gone. Away, I ain't never going back. Only thing I'm in a paper sack. I'm all alone, and I'm lost from day and night. I need someone's hand.
carry me when I'm tired. Got to go. I can't stay here no more. That mean old bartender just showed me the door. Somewhere, somehow, I'll win my fight someday, and we'll all be together on that broad highway.
On that broad highway.